Hello everyone, welcome to another Social Dad podcast. I think this is episode 48. Today I'm with Miles from Ally Therapy. Hi Miles.
Hello James. Thanks for having me on. Very good, doing great. It's a Friday and Friday afternoon and yeah. Yourself?
Yeah, I'm all right. I had my second run. I've just started getting back into running because I was thinking I'm not doing enough things that make me happy. And I've been trying to make each month have a new resolution. So instead of the year's New Year's resolution, which puts too much pressure on it, and then by March, nothing happens. So I'm trying to mix up and do one every month. And this month is running.
Right on. Right
and on. I went...
specific goals around it?
No. No, just run. And then if you get tired, you walk or you jog or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's been really nice.
Excellent.
And then I saw a dog who had a massive stick in his mouth and he looked super happy and that cheered me up. So it's, you know, it's the little things.
Does that make it feel rewarding?
Yeah. I'm very sort of task based. And so if I feel like I've ticked something off, then I feel like I've accomplished something.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Good stuff. Yeah. Right on.
So, you're a cognitive behavioral therapist. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. Cognitive behavioral therapist.
Okay.
It wasn't the therapy I started out with in school. It was more psychodynamic, kind of a bit of the old school talk therapy. But, about 4 years ago, I started at, a mental health hospital just outside of, on the outskirts of the greater Toronto area called Ontario Shores, and started getting trained in cognitive behavioral therapy, which kind of felt like night and day with the standard talk therapy and how to help people struggling with anxiety, depression, related issues like that. I mean, it can include OCD, even trauma. It's just a lot more, results oriented, more of a focus on goals. I mean, cognitive behavioral, those two words break down the two main tools for that I work with clients on the cognitive element. There's cognitive restructuring, which is really changing the way you feel by changing the way you interpret your situations. And then on the behavioral area, it's really identifying where avoidance is taking place in your life and countering that avoidance with different exposure exercises that are basically getting out of your comfort zone in order to build up your tolerance to uncertainty. And when you combine the two of those, it's a real game changer. It's, you know, people start to see results a lot sooner.
So that's the difference between like what I'd call regular therapy, and you're saying that's talk based versus cognitive behavioral, where you're thinking about it and then you're changing the way you act in different situations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The standard talk therapy, it can be a real mixed bag. You don't know what you're getting with that. It could be very casual. It could be spending a lot of time talking about your past, getting your thoughts out in the open, and there's a lot of great benefit to that. And you can have talk therapists who are structured. Maybe they have an agenda for how they want the session to go out in a way that is collaborative, or even have sort of assignments or, you know, air quotes, homework of what you can be practicing between appointments. But with CBT, it's a lot more of a priority of, okay, these are the tools we're going to learn in our sessions, and let's make sure we put them into practice between sessions, because it's outside of your session where that's where your struggles exist, not necessarily in the session room. And very akin to physiotherapy. You have to be putting in that work to see those results.
Why do you think this still, I mean, I know people have done a lot to sort of break down the stigma of therapy, whichever type. Why do you think it still exists?
It's a great question. Why does it still exist? You know, I am in a bit of a bubble. Being a therapist, I don't hear so many of the criticisms made about it, because by the time I'm working with a client, they're already somewhat invested. They've taken that big first step. Versus if I were talking with friends, and maybe this has to do with my friend group. A lot of my friends, I don't know if it's because they're millennials as well. There's a lot more of that openness, this kind of recognition that, yeah, why not, you know, speak with a therapist, see if there's something going on. I bet if I were to talk more to, say, a boomer.
I think it is something to do with our age group, where we're a lot more open to seeking help. And I think it's almost there where we equate mental health with physical health. So like if you hurt your knee, for example, you'd go and see a physio, you'd go and see an acupuncturist. If there's something going on with your head, you go and see a therapist.
Right.
And they're almost, I think, and a lot of people, especially with our age group, I think it's one of those things where you're nervous to say it, but then once you do, of course, yeah, it's fine. I mean, it's a good thing, obviously, but it's almost there. So do you think people are nervous about seeing a new therapist?
Yeah, and I could say the same about for myself when I've gone to see therapists, or let's say there is a new therapist I want to go see, I'm going to have my guard up a little bit. I know I'm speaking with a professional, but there can be that instinct that says they don't know me, and they're going to start asking me all these personal questions that are kind of one way directed. That can feel very intrusive. And if you are by any means struggling with insecurities with who you are, doesn't necessarily feel great to have that question. And that can be impacted by underlying trust, that's influenced by so many factors, especially with how is trust growing up? Have you ever experienced any extreme betrayal? Overall, what is one's experience with being vulnerable with someone else? And if vulnerability maybe wasn't okay, maybe it wasn't safe to be vulnerable growing up, to just begin doing that later on in life with a complete stranger can feel instinctually like going in the complete unsafe direction. So I think that might play a bit into what you're asking earlier around that stigma is being that idea about being vulnerable, or to add another piece, that there are so many cliches associated with therapists in pop culture.
Yeah.
Like, you know, this idea about having to talk about your relationship with your mother. And
yeah, you lie on the couch and say, okay, talk about your mom.
Oh, just keep talking. And of course, there's pop culture loves to make teases at therapists. I don't know if you ever watched that show Afterlife with Ricky Gervais.
Yeah, I just finished the last season of that.
Okay. I haven't watched the later seasons. I've watched all the first, but you know the therapist in that one.
Yeah. He is
the epitome of everything a therapist shouldn't do. And he's such a great caricature of that.
Yeah.
But
that's a really good show, because I think that and Ricky Gervais does an incredible job of portraying someone who has he goes through an awful loss, but yeah. then sort of almost separates himself from his mental well-being and says, like, I can do what I want now, and if anything goes wrong, I'll just kill myself. Right. And then in the third season, he describes that as he thought that was his superpower, but it turns out that's what mental illness is, or mm-hmm. his type of mental illness. Mm-hmm. And I can relate to that quite, like, during sort of puberty and even in my 20s, like I always thought that kind of thing, it seemed sensible. Like it made sense that you could just sort of, you know, finish yourself off or unalive yourself. And I thought that was, you know, it kind of made sense. Like if things weren't going your way, you could just do that. But now yeah. I realize that is an illness. It's not a way of healthy thought.
Right. Yeah, it's amazing the how our minds can look at different forms of coping, and our minds can get very creative with this. But suicidal thinking is not an uncommon one. When feeling overwhelmed, when engaged in, let's say, perpetual pernicious suffering, where there's just not a lot of feeling of hope, if there's that thought, well, I could pull the plug at any moment, when it gets too bad, there's comfort in that, right?
It's an escape plan.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then imagine 10, 20 or more years of that sort of brain pattern repeating itself. It becomes very automatic. And just as well with other forms of, like, self-harm behaviors, that can be another common one that is not the same as suicide. It can be very distinct from it, but self-harm behaviors can be a very powerful form of, at least temporarily, coping through whatever emotional pain is going on for that person at that time.
Yeah. I was talking to a friend of mine who's he's called Sean Butler. He's a therapist at the North Shore Stress and Anxiety Clinic. I was talking to him about this interview that was coming up, and he gave me some questions. So if someone was to start therapy, how do they know if they found a good match?
Well, in terms of good match, the good match piece, there's going to be a lot of intuition that falls into that, that I don't know if words are enough to describe that piece. I think if you have at least a therapist who knows how to validate your experience within that first session, and within that first session can instill a sense of hope that maybe you haven't felt in a long time, that's a good sign of a good match. When I was in school, I remember hearing that we use this term therapeutic alliance, and it's a big factor necessary in order for change to happen, and it can operate independent of the modality you use. Therapeutic alliance is so fundamental. And I remember hearing two independent stats in school. One professor was saying that it takes about 3 to 4 sessions to build that therapeutic rapport. And then I heard another professor in that same year say that about 50% of clients drop out within the first 3 to 4 sessions. When I heard this, it was an indicator for me that, okay, it's, we got to really nail down that therapeutic rapport. And you'll run into therapists, some really look at prioritizing that, and some who are maybe a bit more casual about it. And if you're not getting that earnest need to want to make that connection, then I would say maybe it's not a good fit. At the same time, I think it's worth giving it at least 3 or 4 sessions, mm-hmm. to figure that out, because sometimes a therapist can feel like they're not a good fit because they're hitting all the right buttons, but maybe a little quicker than you were hoping for.
Yeah.
And I, for example, with a supervisor I had, she was the most influential supervisor when I was working. She was doing a lot of work on me unintentionally, I think, because she, anytime I was struggling with a client, she would really bring it back to me and then was helping me do a lot of work on myself. And I'd leave some of these supervision sessions feeling pretty, not so great. Like where I just felt like I went through a bit of a marathon emotionally.
Yeah.
But those were the ones where it's because she was testing a lot of my preconceived notions of myself, and it didn't feel great at the time, but shortly after I thought, thank you. I needed to hear that. So sometimes there are therapists that don't tell you what you want to hear, but will tell you what you need to hear. And so it's trying to find a balance between those two.
As a therapist, how do you deal with hearing a lot of people's problems all day?
Yeah. Pretty early on as a therapist, you have to learn how to set those boundaries effectively. A big one is when you hear, and the hardest one is probably hearing people going through who've experienced a history of abuse. Different forms of trauma can be some of the most difficult ones. Recognizing that where my responsibility is in trying to help them. It's not my job to go back in time and prevent it from happening. That's of course magical thinking. My job isn't to fully experience what they've experienced. There's naturally an empathy that comes out where I can feel something strongly from someone sharing an experience, but I think that part of it is recognizing or setting that boundary in the session. There's a setting a boundary outside the session. So I'm not trying to be too preoccupied with what someone has told me. There's the odd one. Like I think as I've, you know, I'm a father of three, and as a dad, sometimes hearing the child abuse story hits differently, right?
Since yeah.
Compared to before having kids, and having heard some of those stories, there were a handful of incidents where I would have a disturbing dream, and I know it was because a client had shared a story with me. Fortunately, I haven't had too many of those experiences, but when I do, I recognize, yeah, my brain's trying to process that.
Yeah, but it's hard with dreams because. It feels like you live through it. Like I've had a couple of dreams where I've dreamt that I've lost my daughter and it feels real and it's devastating. It took me a long time to get over it.
Yeah.
And you just wake up and it feels like you've gone through it and you think, oh, I today is a write-off kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that sort of moves us on to parenting. And I think, as well as the stigma of getting therapy, which is being worked on, and I think is going away, dad's getting therapy, that feels like something that either doesn't happen very often or it's not talked about.
Right. In general, there's far more women attend therapy than men.
Why?
It's a great question. I think there's cultural norms around acceptance, around vulnerability.
Mm-hmm. I think dads have to be strong, especially in the eyes of their kids. Like, I want my daughter to think, you know, I could take on Superman, nothing shakes me, that kind of stuff. But she's seen me cry and she's seen me be sad. And I think that's important to know that I'm a human and vulnerable. Having said that, dads around other dads, or even dads in front of their partners, we want to be the rock. We want to be strong. And so either admitting to the fact that we need therapy or going to therapy, I think there's a huge hurdle there.
Mm-hmm. I would like to say I don't personally relate to that, but I do. There are times where I've felt it, where, especially during this pandemic, the stress is weighing on you. There's those periods of burnout, and you get to that point where you think, okay, how am I managing this well? Like, how am I managing all the stressors in my life? Is it adequate? Do I need support from somebody else? And I remember even last year when I went and saw a therapist, I really loved what he said. My therapist at the time, he told me, well, it's, especially when you're talking about issues within your own, say, family of origin, it's a big step, because if there's any family dysfunction, one of the untold rules is you don't talk about this outside the family. Like, there seems to be an interesting correlation between with greater family dysfunction can be greater family loyalty of keeping the problems within the family. Mm-hmm. So that nobody talks about the problems. And then you're just looping the same problems over and over again.
That's interesting.
So, yeah. I heard the same idea kind of repeated when I recently read a book, The Prince of Tides, that my mom had recommended. And it was quite fantastic. It's a great portrait of family dysfunction and how it goes, honestly, from generation to generation. But yeah, I think coming back to your question, James, about why don't dads reach out as much? You know, in my caseload, I work more with women, and mostly the men I work with are it's in couples therapy, so they're coming with their partner, and more often it's the female partner.
Yeah, it's not his idea.
Yeah. So, and at the same time, James, I do have to say, there's an art that therapy is a feminine art, and there's
what do you
more
mean by that?
By feminine art, there's more of a like the nurturing approach that happens in therapy tends to appeal more towards people who draw more, and males as can have more of a female orientation than males, and vice versa. There tends to be those who are more sensitive that tend to have more of an openness to it.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard that, and I don't know enough to talk about this at length, but treating men for depression is not necessarily the same way to treat women for depression. And I think that by men and women, it's more like more feminine oriented versus masculine oriented. Mm-hmm. Let's say if it's more masculine oriented, there's often more of an appeal towards getting like something that's more task oriented, like more say physically related. If it's lifting weights, for example, men tend to respond very well to that when they're struggling with depression. Now it can be a struggle when there's a depression at such a level that the motivation to even engage in that is too severe. And so maybe the therapy intervention works better. But I think for a lot of men, they get something different from feeling like they're achieving something, accomplishing something, and that can have a lot of great results. It doesn't necessarily help when it comes to something like doing a bit of that internal reflection.
Yeah. So is that where the cognitive behavioral side of things comes in, maybe better for the more masculine way of thinking? Like, it gives you sort of tasks and less and sort of ways to like a toolbox, if you like, to your day, where you can say, okay, this is this situation, this is how I should be thinking about it, and this mm-hmm. is how I am thinking about it and how I can change. Whereas more traditionally feminine ways of thinking are sort of, they want to talk about it and have a sort of chat about their feelings and why they feel that way.
Yeah, I don't know how to answer that one specifically, whether it's more like for CBT for masculine versus feminine. Like, that's a good question. There's going to be people who are just oriented more to more goal oriented than others, more tool oriented. When like because there's so I first got the training in CBT because it's. There's a lot of appeal if you want to be able to provide therapy within fewer sessions, like that is providing results. And CBT has that benefit where it can provide the results within a shorter time frame. I think one big pitch that's been made in support of CBT for, say, something like moderate depression is the results that you would get within, say, 2 years of standard talk therapy, you can get within 4 months of CBT. That's a great marketing pitch, right? Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean it works for everybody at that speed. Yeah. Some people where they want the tool that they can then start practicing independently, it's gonna resonate very well. Whereas, yeah, some people it needs to go and in more depth with unpacking layers. So yeah, I think even like I'll get clients that come to me like through Ally Therapy. I'll often ask clients what made them want to start working with me versus other therapists on the team. And I'm often getting a response. And this is coming more from women than men, is they said, I saw you talking about CBT tools, or tools that can help with depression, or tools that can help with setting boundaries and asserting oneself. And they'll say, like, that's something I'm really struggling with, and I want something specific to help with this specific problem.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's sort of, it's more targeted, I guess. Yeah, I've thought about going to therapy many times, and sort of one of them, well, there's a few things that are sort of mental barriers, I suppose. One is the cost. Two is the time time spent away from my family or things that I feel like I should be doing. And then the other thing is, like, I'm kind of nervous about opening the floodgates.
Okay. So by the floodgates, would you, do you mean by like getting so emotionally overwhelming that you won't be able to stop?
I don't know. Like, I feel like some days I'm just it's I've got all my worries and all my problems and all the suppressed memories. They're in a big balloon and it's tied up, and if I pop it, I don't know what happened.
Okay. Yeah. There are so many individuals say, like, we'll say the same thing. And there's a lot of unknown right there. There's so much uncertainty, and uncertainty is terrifying. And therapy is, if it's effective therapy, it will help you build up that tolerance to uncertainty. Often when we have this idea of something uncertain, we don't know what's on the other side, and there's an element of, and I won't be able to cope with that outcome, whatever it is. It's whatever is unknown is dangerous, and I can't deal with it. And we underestimate our ability to cope with issues. We can easily dismiss how we've coped with hard, difficult, traumatic, tragic situations in the past. But one thing that comes to mind, James, on this piece is when you get to that, like those floodgates, almost like they're gonna burst, or something's about to pop. An image I like to use instead is releasing a pressure valve, where on a pressure cooker that's just built up so much. It's not that it's going to explode. It's a whole bunch of pressure is going to release. There's going to be a lot of noise there. There's going to be a lot of, discomfort, emotion. And I've heard this contemporary philosopher named Alain de Botton talk about this. He talks about how when we're in situations where we're quite agitated, frustrated, just feeling really low, whatever that strong negative emotion is, in those states, we're on the verge of a bit of an emotional breakthrough. And we can't experience that breakthrough until we've crossed that point. And I've experienced this personally many times, where I have to get into that state, and that might be where I'm either talking with my therapist or with my spouse, and it doesn't feel great, but it can be a state where I do get weepy. I might be in tears. I'm feeling just so emotionally raw, and that emotional raw state hits a peak for a very brief period. It's not very long. But then on the other side of that comes this profound clarity in recognizing what I need to do next, what I need to do to fix whatever problem is contributing to that distress. And so I'm certainly promoting getting to that point if that is what's going on. It'll help you learn more about yourself. And there's the to be gained from that is, well, that greater insight is only going to help you and those around you, because you're going to be a better you as a result.
It's interesting. Like, it's funny, like those kinds of emotional breakthroughs or stress reliefs or anything like that is, it's a rare feeling. I think, when, especially when you have a sort of a bit of a breakthrough, you think, oh, that's why I've felt that way for my entire life. And it's it's funny, like, for the past, and like, I don't know, 20 years probably, I've hated my birthday, hated it, and I've not looked forward to it at all. And I would get very sad, and I'd get sort of, I'd push people away and get very upset, and I'd say, I don't want to celebrate it. And it's only recently that I've discovered that it's not my birthday that I didn't like. It was the fact that when I was at sort of middle school, so I was, I don't know, 13 or something, from then on, summer holidays, my birthday is in July 17th. So summer holidays was always hit a couple of weeks before. And because I lived out in the countryside, I wouldn't see my friends until we go back to school in September. And so I'd feel very, very lonely. And the birthday, I'd try and make plans, but, you know, people are away, they're doing their own thing. That was the sort of crux of the summer. And I'd feel very, very lonely. I'd feel sad that people couldn't come out for my birthday, that kind of thing. And I've only just made the connection that it's not my birthday that I don't like. I mean, now I've got my family around. I've got a daughter and I've got my in-laws and everyone else who actually want to celebrate it, and I could never understand why. But it's the feeling of loneliness that I got from living out in the countryside and not seeing my friends for months. Mm-hmm. That's what I didn't like. And so now I can celebrate my birthday, and it's nice, and it's a good occasion. But it took me that long to realize. And I suppose if I'd actually gone to therapy, then I would have realized that a long time ago.
Well, what was it like when you made that discovery, when you found that association there?
It was a big weight off, because my birthday was always something that it was like, oh, don't talk about my birthday. I don't want anything. Don't celebrate it. It would make me sad to even thinking about it. And now, and even like my wife and my daughter, and they'd want to celebrate. And they'd say, well, we want to make it, you know, a big deal of it. And we want to give you cards and presents and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I'd say, no, I don't want it. And now I can celebrate with them. And it's an occasion.
Right. So that's wonderful example. So often things that trigger us are just, they upset us and we don't know why.
Mm-hmm.
There's an association going on under the surface, and it's amazing how it can continue to just wear at us if we don't take a moment to reflect and go, what's going on here? Why am I so worked up by this?
My wife would always say, why don't you like your birthday? Mm-hmm. And I'd sort of sit and think, and I'm like, as far as I can remember, unless I've suppressed it, nothing major happened on my, like, nothing, no scarring events, nothing horrible. And I would say, I don't know. And, you know, she'd sort of almost get angry and say, well, there must be something. I think, what if there is? I don't know what it is. For years. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it took, I don't know, I was probably out for a walk or something. And then it clicked. I'm like, oh, yeah, right. That makes sense.
So it was just kind of a random moment when it clicked for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really. Yeah. Yeah. No, that's it. Yeah. With, like, when it comes to being in a therapy room, or, you know, whether, you know, it's so popular to do this online now, to have that space that is meant to be sacred, that is meant to be with respect, with a therapist who wants you to be able to be vulnerable and to be that soundboard that says, you're not crazy because you're feeling this way or you're thinking these thoughts. And sometimes it's just some of the simplest of those probing questions that we don't ask ourselves. Mm-hmm. And when we connect, it's like, well, yeah, that answer was there the whole time.
Yeah, I think it's often when yeah, so it feels like something is the catalyst, or you sort of you put a behavior or a feeling around something specific, whether it's a person or a type of people or an event or a day or anything. And I find myself, if I have a strong feeling about something, like my birthday, it's almost the sort of the non-specific specific thing. Like, it could have been anything. It could have been the day before my birthday, or it could have been the beginning of July, or halfway through, or anything. Or even going for bike rides, because I would go for bike rides by myself because I was out in the countryside and there's nothing else to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could have hated riding a bike.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have no clue why.
Yeah.
Until I realized what the bigger thing was going on and why I was feeling that way. And, you know, I grew up not really thinking about my feelings. Like, no one ever talked about it.
Right.
And yeah. So you don't sort of make the connection.
That's right. That's right. And I think with every subsequent generation, there's way more open to this. There's way more promotion of parents towards their kids,
mm-hmm.
around things like getting to use a feeling word to express themselves, to build up that emotional vocabulary. It's something my wife and I do with our kids, and it's definitely a work in progress to, because it's hard to necessarily know, even as adults. It's like, I don't know what I'm feeling. I know I feel not good. But is it fear? A big one I use with clients is helping to identify the difference between primary and secondary emotions. Quite often.
What's the difference?
Well, a typical secondary emotion might be frustration or anger. I'm just feeling angry. I'm feeling angry at something. Maybe my a friend of mine didn't include me in a weekend cottage trip. Let's say I'm feeling really, really ticked off by that. But if I stay at that secondary level, it's hard for me to really do much work. I'm kind of stuck there. Versus if I can identify a more primary emotion, which might be something like fear, or hurt, or sadness, or loneliness,
mm-hmm.
then you can kind of get to what's really going on. It's the more vulnerable emotion. Things like anger, frustration. They're more of a defensive sort of emotion, where, you know, sometimes it is not safe to be to show hurt, to show fear. And so you have to respond with anger.
And I think that can build up.
It can build up, yeah.
To a point where it affects the people around you as well as yourself. Like, I was thinking the other night how someone, a friend of mine had the flu, not COVID or anything, just a normal flu, which you don't really hear about anymore because everyone's wearing masks. But, and someone said, oh, you got man flu. And I thought, I started to sort of think about it, and it bothered me that people, usually women and wives and things, say, oh, he's got man flu, because it seemed to sort of overdramatic. But then I was thinking, well, personally, like, I, unless it's like a really bad flu, I won't even mention it. Like, if I've got a bit of a cold or sniffles or sore throat or something, I'm not going to even bring it up in conversation. I'll either sort of tough it out or have a Tylenol and move on with my life. And so I don't tend to say anything about what's wrong with me until it gets so bad I can't bear it, and then I have to say it. And I think that's partly because of the stigma of saying that there's anything wrong, right, whether it's a physical or a mental thing.
Yeah, there's, I agree. I agree, James. I think there's, and like you said, like the, a man flu or a man cold, there can be these gender stereotypes, that definitely don't, they don't really extend an olive branch towards vulnerability. It kind of does the reverse, versus, yeah, sorry to hear that you've got a flu or that you're feeling sick. And just providing a little bit of that empathy, that validation can go a long way towards helping a person get that feedback that says, hey, I can be vulnerable here. I can, because I'm not feeling great, and maybe I'm going to feel more okay to be vulnerable in the future.
Yeah. So with ally therapy, which is where you work, on the website it says therapy tools to support you during parenthood. Mm-hmm. So do you work exclusively with parents?
No, it's so Ally has marketed themselves. We've marketed ourselves to provide support for families, for young families. It's not exclusive to that, but we've seen a growing demand for that since the pandemic started. After, especially when all the lockdowns were going on,
yeah,
it was just unreal for everybody. And I can personally speak from the role of a parent. I remember we had at the time, I think our youngest was three, and our other one was like 4 months old back in March of 2020, and we just found out we were expecting our third. And yeah, it was pretty hectic to figure out how you manage all this chaos. The chaos is one thing when you're, you know, pre-COVID, but during the pandemic, yeah, it just feel like it was exacerbated. And because of lockdowns, there were a lot of limits on how you go about it. So the big one is, yeah, virtual therapy. And it's wonderful how acceptance around virtual therapy has just boomed and continues to be popular despite a lot of places opening up, because it does wonders to increase accessibility. A lot of parents come to us because it's nice to have a therapist who knows what it's like to be a parent.
Yeah.
Or is in the ongoing process of parenthood. I remember once when I was in school for therapy and talking to this one guy who just asked me what I was taking in school. And I said, told him I was interested in family therapy. And he said something to the effect of, I could never go to a therapist who didn't have kids, because they would never understand what it was like. I was a bit put off by that, because I thought, well, do you need to have a therapist who's experienced everything you've experienced in order to validate your experience, like, or to empathize or provide you with any kind of effective support? Mm-hmm. But that was me before I had kids. And after having it, I would say that I wouldn't reach out only for myself to have a therapist who's also had kids.
But it helps.
It's nice.
Yeah, it's like a little common ground that you have.
Yeah, yeah, that's a big part of that. Now, my wife Allison, she also works for Ally, and that's kind of bridged me into Ally therapy as well. Is she's had an interest in perinatal health, like perinatal mental health. There's such an unsupported group of postpartum parents, particularly mothers who like, you know, postpartum depression is largely undiagnosed. And it doesn't mean that it necessarily needs to be diagnosed, but there's a lot of that need of people who go through that's big transition in life and need that help. And so, it's been wonderful to be part of this team that has this focus. For myself, I definitely don't have that too much of that experience. My role with Ally has been providing, like, my caseload with Ally is primarily couples and new couple, like, you know, couples who have been and parented less than 5 years in many cases, sometimes less than a year, and couples, like couples with kids. It's interesting to do therapy sessions now virtually, because a lot of these couples, there's not a lot of personal time to do therapy. Similar to what you mentioned earlier, James, but quite often in the sessions, it's virtual. Baby will be in the background, baby, you know, interacting, and I'm completely comfortable with that as long as they are. And it's kind of neat to see that, to see, hey, you can still make this work.
It's difficult though. It's hard to sort of, I mean, sometimes, like, when I'm thinking about, you know, the way I think, it's really hard if you've got someone who requires any kind of attention. Mm-hmm. And it makes it really hard to sort of deep dive into your brain, I find.
The deep dive stuff, there is something I found really profound in working with couples with a baby in session, is there's a different pressure applied with having to really get down to it. One of the advantages of working with couples versus individuals is there's less time trying to figure out less time to figure out what's each person's main problem. I remember learning this when I was in school. An individual, you might spend some time with that person's not really sure what their main issue is, but in couples work, you just have to ask the partner. They're going to point it out right away. It's like, I know what your problem is.
What your problem is.
Yeah. It's like, I've gotten to know you very well. And so they see right through each other. And I mean, that helps with part of getting past some hurdles.
Mm-hmm.
But it is often quite tools. It's tools focused in a way with couples. I like to use, a method called Imago dialogue. This comes from a psychologist, Harville Hendricks, who uses this sort of technical approach to better communication, where you basically try to mirror what the other person is saying. You don't necessarily agree with it. Mm-hmm. And it's often because you don't agree that leads to objections and defensiveness, but that just shuts the conversation down and then no communication's happening. With Imago, it's more mirroring that person's experience. You're going to have your rebuttal or whatever it is after they've said what they need to say. You mirror their experience, you validate their experience, and you empathize their experience. And when you do that effectively, the defenses come down rapidly. And there's more of a feeling of safety and becoming more vulnerable. And then the roles switch and you try that again. And this is a tool I try to work with clients to have sort of a tool to bring home and to practice. And, you know, some couples can, not everyone can. And that's fine, because it's, you know, you're in a very busy stage of life and you don't necessarily have time for that. But the other piece with couples is helping them recognize that when they are in an argument, it has a little bit to do with the argument or the situation at hand, and it has a lot to do with the household each of them grew up in that is making them have a strong response to what might otherwise be a very trivial small thing. Kind of like, why are you so upset around your birthday? And part of that is helping each one go, oh, this is because, you know, for example, you might have one partner who really, really struggles to assert her needs to her partner. And she might just, you know, shut down or not bring it up, not even ask what she wants, but her partner wants her to ask, but she doesn't do it. And a little bit of digging might figure out that in the household she grew up in, it was never okay to do that. It was, or when she had tried to do that as a child, it was dismissed. It was met with indifference, or some sort of shaming went on. And so that it's hard to just accept that growing up and then as an adult, just turn it off. It, you know, those wounds run deep. And so when a partner can recognize that and go, okay, I didn't know that. I didn't know that with you. And there's that vulnerability. Then there's a better understanding on how to adapt that and make that change. And so that there's growth going at this, like a together growth happening.
How would you deal with someone who, they're very insistent on making sure they get their entire thought out, and not be talked over?
Mm.
Like it's always a sticking, like even if the other person wants to start saying something and move the conversation along, they can't move on until they've said their bit.
Yeah. Well, in the short bit of it, it would be, I think it would be really important to allow that, because perhaps that individual has not had a lot of validation in their past, and they need a space, and that can be tiresome, that can, like to the person receiving it, but some of that is that maybe they're trying to process as they speak out. This is a common piece when I find with a lot of couples where one partner will be the explainer, the talker, and the other partner is more the solution focus. Well, let's fix this, like the fixer in the relationship. And those two partners will often clash because the fixer just wants to, you know, jump right to how do we figure this out? And the explainer is figuring it out. Like the solution is through that process of speaking and doesn't want any kind of solution from the other partner, often just wants an ear to speak to. And it's part of the fixer's role to recognize, oh, this is fixing it right now. It's not at the same speed I'd like, but there's a lot of good happening right here. And I speak from personal example, James, because that was early in my relationship with my partner.
Yeah.
Not to say that my wife is talks on long conversations, but she needs to express herself when something's going on, and she doesn't need me to necessarily fix it. And that was a big thing for me to have to adjust to, because if I'm just jumping right in on how to fix it, that's very invalidating to do that. So. I think it's recognizing if you're the receiver of someone who needs to take a long time to explain something, to recognize it's probably far more valuable than you think, even if it weren't something that you would personally benefit from. We each have different modes of processing problems and dealing with problems.
Yeah. I think that's good advice. Sometimes the person talking to you, I've heard a couple of people say that when they have conversations with their partner, they say at the beginning of the sort of potential conflict or conversation, they say, is this something you want help with? Like, do you want advice or just to talk? And then if they say, I just want to talk, then they say, okay, great. And it helps them, helps the other person to receive and listen in an appropriate fashion, where they are not going in expecting to come up with solutions or thinking that they're helping by saying, okay, here's what we're going to do. Because the other person finds it completely invalidating, and it's that's not what they need from the conversation. So they go away feeling more stressed and not having received the sort of closure that they want. And they could have had, you know, half an hour ago, but now the conversation escalates into an argument. One, the listening party runs off and gets frustrated and says, oh, this is... Alex, and then and it's okay, that's good to hear.
If partners can kind of clarify at the beginning to set the stage, that's excellent. That's likely a sign that they're good communicators.
But sometimes you can't preempt that.
Sometimes you can't preempt that. That's right. But you often get to know what your partner's needs are if they've been able to express it in the past, and you kind of get that pattern figured out. Sometimes it needs to be repeated. We need to be reminded. It's like, I don't need you to fix anything. I just need you to listen to me. And then I go, okay, I can get into my listening, you know, put on my listening cap, not my solution focus cap. We're more likely to get into those fights when we're already tired. More exhausted, and we don't have that same awareness of what our partner needs in the moment. And you know, within couples who've got little ones, it's the busiest stage of their life, and I've had to remind couples of that quite a bit, and I need to be reminded of that myself every so often, because when I'm not doing well, I unconsciously think of myself as an exception to that rule. And that's when I get into big trouble.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'll let you know. It's kind of like sort of going in to a game of rock, paper, scissors, but the goal is to have each person have an opposing thing. So if two people are coming in as rocks, they're going to clash. But if one person is coming in with a rock and the other is paper, then that's a good thing. They create, you know, a sort of unity, and then they can move forward.
Absolutely, yeah. It is nice when there's where you can provide for that partner where they can't for themselves, and vice versa. Mm-hmm. Yeah, versus being married to the exact same person. Wouldn't be too interesting, and it wouldn't be too helpful.
Exactly. I just went on your our therapist page on ally.io, and that is a nice sweater you're wearing. I love it.
Well, thank you. You know what? That is by far my most complimented wardrobe item. You have to credit my wife on that one. That was an American. I don't know if it was American Apparel. It was American Eagle. Yeah, long time ago. But that is if it doesn't say anything, it says therapist, right?
It says therapist/grandpa. it's great. It's really perfect.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
I love it. Let's just close out with some plugs. Where can people find you?
I mean, it's great to be able to have these services available online. I mean, it's just, ally.io. IO is the Google domain. And it's really, you know, if you want to see me, you can just go onto my profile page and it says Book with Miles. If not, there's on the main page, you can take a brief questionnaire about what you're looking for, and the questionnaire can help match you up to a therapist on our team that may be the best fit. We can provide therapy services throughout Canada. We even have some therapists who are located in BC as well as Nova Scotia. I'm based in Ontario, but we have therapists on our team with a wide variety of skills, and we also offer a free, you know, no pressure 15-minute intro session, so you can have that opportunity to meet with your therapist or meet with a therapist you think you'd want to work with, and see if you can get that feel for if it might be a good fit. 15 minutes isn't much, but it kind of gives you a little bit of something to put a face to interact with.
Mm-hmm.
So I highly recommend anybody who's interested to reach out, and if any of us don't believe we have whatever skills that or specialty that they're looking for, we certainly try to make a referral to a better service.
Perfect. Thanks so much. I'll put the links in the show notes as well, so you can just click
on those. All right. Thanks so much, James.
Thanks, Miles. Appreciate it.
You take care.